Hi, thanks for coming to the sessions. We have two parts. The first part is called "What is a Yoetzet Halacha and What Does She Do?" And that's describing the role, the training, the function of Yoetzet Halacha. The second part, which is also going to be an hour-long session, is going to be taking the types of questions, halacha questions that we deal with, and looking at them together, analyzing them together, talking about them together, so you can understand in a more hands-on way what I'm talking about. So the first part is more of a description from inside-outside, in the sense of I'm an insider, but it's still an outside description of what's done, and the second part is going to be looking at really the content of what goes on. So some initial background about the program. First of all, literally, Yoetzet means consultant. Yoetz is a consultant, Yoetzet is the female. Plural would be Yoatzot. Halacha, Jewish law. Yoetzet Halacha would be a female consultant in Jewish law. There is a story behind this title. And the story is that in 1997, Rabbanit Chana Henkin, her husband Rav Yehuda Herzl Henkin, and Rav Yaakov Varhavtik, who's also a very highly respected rabbi in Israel, got together to formulate a formal training program for women in the laws of Tahavat HaMishpacha, or the laws of Nida. And one thing that was clear to them was the overarching purpose of what they were doing. And the overarching purpose was to take women's learning, which had undergone a sort of revolution in the 20th century, and had started to get to a stage at which more and more women were more and more confident in learning primary texts for ourselves, and to take that skill and apply it to an area of halacha where the community in particular could benefit from that knowledge. And the natural area to first apply it to was the laws of Nida, since that's an area of halacha that's largely entrusted or given over to women to observe, that relates to very sensitive matters that aren't necessarily always the most comfortable to discuss between a woman and a man. And so a female questioner is not always as comfortable as she might be talking to a rabbi. The idea was to harness women's learning to meet a need in the community. And when they came up with that idea, there was a question about, and this question should resonate in light of recent discussions about women and rabbinical titles. I say recent discussions, but it seems to be an ongoing discussion for many years now. When they arrived at the decision to create this training program in this area of Jewish law, there was a question about what to call women who had undergone the program and become certified. We'll talk more about the program in a minute. And the story goes that an Israeli newspaper picked up the information and started to write in a headline that Nishmat had created a program or was going to graduate Poskot Halacha, female halachic decisors, which is not actually what Nishmat had in mind. And when they got wind of this, Rabbanit Henkin said, "Can please don't write that." They said, "Okay, well, it has to be the same amount of letters, and you have to get back to us within a few hours." And so the title Yoetzot Halacha was born. So it wasn't necessarily the most premeditated title, but there's something very nice about it. A consultant is someone who is knowledgeable, who can bring things to the table that experts around the table might not always be able to see for themselves, but at the same time is not claiming ultimate authority in what he or she is doing. Okay, so first some background about the background of people who come into this program. Who are the people who are looking to become Yoetzot Halacha? Is that even legible?
It's
not really legible. Okay, so I'm going to assume that people can't necessarily read. Maybe that helps.
Turn up the light on that side. Better.
Okay, I need to be able to read my notes.
Sorry.
So the Seder.
Everybody has it in their handouts anyway.
Yeah, it's not a problem. background of the women who come into this program. What criteria do we look for in looking for women to train? And there are a few major considerations. The first is basic scholarship. Now that we're talking about a program that's meant to leverage women's learning to help the community, it makes sense that the women who join the community, who join the program, should already be at a certain level of learning, so that they're ready to understand what they're going to do. And also because from day one, the material that you learn within the program is something that you wind up being responsible for later. So although obviously there is some development in understanding and in skills over the course of the program, it doesn't make sense for someone to come in without a certain amount of scholarship. So one basic criterion would be the scholarship. They usually say something like 4 years of a learning background, though that can be a little bit more flexible. Second major factor is leadership potential. When we're talking about investing time, training, energy in a cohort of women to learn these areas and contribute to the community, it makes sense to do that for women that the belief is will actually run with the skills that they have and develop programs also of their own initiative to help other women. So leadership potential is an important factor. The third, no less important than the other two, is religious commitment. Because someone can be very learned and be a leader, but Reshit Chochma Yirat Shamayim, if someone is not coming first and foremost from a standpoint of fear of heaven, it's not clear what exactly the training is going to lead to. But ultimately, the idea is that the animating spirit of this program is that it should be guided by a true desire to serve Hashem. The cohorts really vary in terms of what actually happens within the program. They make an effort to make it relatively diverse. So there are women who join the program younger, shortly after marriage, and there are women who join at a later stage in life, maybe making a career transition. There are a mix, usually, of women who come from an English-speaking background, which tends to be, even within Israel, it tends to be that women who come from an English-speaking background tend to have an outsized percentage in the community of women who are serious Torah learners within Israel, but trying to balance that with native Israelis, and also they strive for some balance of hashkafot, professional backgrounds. There should be, if there can't be a physician and a nurse in a cohort, it obviously adds something special. If there are women who are coming from, let's say, a social work or psychology, therapy background, that adds something. The idea is that the program is not just about meeting some criteria before you enter, but that it's creating a group that can really learn from each other. What motivates the women in these groups? First and foremost, as befits scholars, the learning. It's an opportunity to learn Torah on a very high level because it's focused on a specific area of halacha, and because there's a responsibility both for certification at the end and for the community to be able to work in the community, to really master to the extent possible that area of halacha. Women have to be very motivated to learn and to learn seriously. A second motivation is to make a contribution to the community. If we're going to have an impact on the community, it's not enough someone should have leadership potential, but it should be that someone is really looking to take whatever tools they have and make the most of them to make change, to help women, to talk to women, to see where there's a struggle and where we can move. I personally can speak of my motivation as having shifted over the course of the program. When I first entered into the program, I think I was more heavily weighted on the learning end. I was very excited about the opportunity as a young married woman to learn these laws on a higher level than I had been able to learn them previously. As I went through the program, the idea of being able to make an impact on the community, to take learning and not just have it be a matter of my personal avodat Hashem, but have it be a practical matter that would make a difference for other people, became more and more prevalent in my own thinking about what was important about what we were doing. And then the third motivating factor is shmirat mitzvot, both our own keeping of the mitzvot and helping other women keep mitzvot. Rav Lichtenstein once was quoted, it's not in writing, but apparently he once said off the cuff that in an ideal world, every woman would be a yoetzet halacha. That the more you know, the more you understand the details of halacha, the more correct you can be in your practice, and the more potential there is for that practice to have deeper meaning for you. And that type of understanding also winds up being conveyed to others. There's a real difference when you learn something from someone whose knowledge goes a drop beyond the level on which they're teaching, and when you learn something from someone whose knowledge really gets to a much deeper level of the learning, or who has taken their own curiosity in that area of study as far as they can take it. And that in and of itself, I think, also helps enable Yotzot Halacha to enhance Shmirat HaMitzvot in the community, because women see how dedicated and how deeply we get into these halachot. What kind of training goes on in the program? The program is, officially, it's a two-year program. It meets 2 days a week, 2 full days a week. It adds up to something like 1,000 hours of study. That's just within the formal program itself. Outside of the program, there's plenty of time. Different women take different amounts of time to review, to fill in, to add to what they're doing. In addition to the 2 days of learning, there's also one night a week of learning that's a little bit less directly halachic. I'll get into that in a minute. How does the halachic training work? It works in a way very similar to the way a classic halachic training program would work, also for men. And in that way, it works actually very differently from how classic halachic learning would work for women. Classically, the way a woman would learn halacha would be primarily through a mimetic process, imitating, looking at what's done around her, seeing what her mother does or talking about it within the community, picking it up, possibly some conversations, but largely learning through seeing. This learning is more textual. The women going into the program are already married. We are still in a paradigm where we're less learning from our mothers now and more learning from texts or from college teachers. But even so, coming into the program already with a basic understanding of what this area of halacha entails, and what this program is filling in is the deeper level of textual learning. One thing that frequently I hear kallot and kallot teachers lament is that there's so much information. Even when someone is capable of learning text on a high level, it's an awful shame to be trying to do it in the 6 weeks before she's getting married, because it's probably one of the worst times possible to try to be retaining any kind of information on a high level. This training involves looking at the text, starting from the Talmudic discussions to the commentaries in the Talmud and the Rishonim, to the Torah, which is early codifier of Jewish law, through the Beit Yosef, which is main commentator on the Torah. The Beit Yosef is also the writer-compiler of the Shulchan Aruch, and to the Nosei Kelim, the major commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch, through Shutim, halachic responsa literature that's written subsequent to that. So it's really, the program really runs the gamut, the full sweep of halachic literature. And one of the striking things about the program is it also is not skipping around, in the sense that Hilchot Nida, by and large, are situated within halachic literature, at least within the halachic codes, and a certain number of what we call simanim, and a certain number of subsections, or subdivisions of the code, one after the other. And in this program, we don't pick and choose. The way that it's learned is thoroughly, step by step, starting from the Gemara, moving through for each and every discussion that comes up within the halachic literature. The classes that take place are of two types. One type of class is sort of a classic, quote-unquote, halacha shir. That means in-depth conceptualization of the material that's under study. So, for example, I mentioned this morning in my talk about how Nida is this interesting intersection between the laws of ritual purity and impurity, and the laws of prohibited sexual relations. let's say one of the first shiurim, one of the first major classes we would have would be to explore what that concept entails from different perspectives. In other words, the main shiur, which is taught by Rav Yaakov Verhofstadt, one of the founders of the program, entails basically taking this bulk of information, not rereading it, but rather assuming that we have a basic knowledge or understanding of what we've read, and conceptualizing it, putting it in context, organizing the information. The second type of shiur is more practical type. That's taught right now by a fellow Yoetzet. Her name is Noah Lau. She's also a dean now at Mishnah. And that type of study, that practical type of study, is taking the material that we've learned, organized, conceptualized, and seeing how it actually comes to play day in and day out in working with women. Now that we've learned what's on the books, what happens in life? How does it really play out? When do these particular issues that we've studied in depth come to have bearing on what a woman actually does? So you have both ends are being addressed, both the kind of more theoretical conceptual approach to halacha and the more practical application-oriented approach to halacha. The final element of the halachic training is also testing, which happens at every stage of the program to make sure that women are keeping pace with the material. In other words, this program takes very seriously the responsibility of the women within it to properly learn the information. There's no shortcuts. There's no golf handicap. The idea is that if you're in the program, you're learning step by step and responsible for everything that you learn. And testing helps ensure that that's what's done along the way. My husband has two different rabbinical ordinations. He learned in Yeshiva University, Prismicha, and he also learned for the test that the Rabbanut Rashit of Israel gives. And he felt very strongly at the time that the type of training that I was having was at a higher level than what he had done. Now, he's a very serious Talmid Chacham. I don't think he meant higher level in the sense of these are objective things, like this shiur is better than that shiur, or this student is better than that student. I don't think that's what he had in mind at all. I think what he had in mind, rather, was that the very focused, specialized nature of the study, coupled with the very highly motivated seriousness of purpose of the cohort, made what we did go to a higher level of understanding. He was more oriented, let's say, when he was learning. He wanted to know the practical things, and he wanted to know what he had to know to fulfill his quote-unquote requirements. And I think what we were doing had a different type of a feel to it, perhaps because the program's a little bit more innovative, perhaps because it's younger, perhaps just because it's more focused. The other interesting element to the training, which is a shift that's gone on over the past recent years, is that originally the program was much more oriented towards independent study. Over the past few years, the program's become a little bit more quote-unquote pre-professional. What I mean is, and this is what we'll get into when we talk about the role of the Yoetzet, I finished study about 13 years ago. The program's around, like I said, since 1997. Since its inception, there's slowly coalesced an idea of what being a Yoetzet Halacha is and is supposed to be. And what that's done is that now it's shaped the program. Rather than it being just sort of an open-ended training program, because we know what we want our graduates to be able to accomplish, the program itself is shaped in a different way to lead the students to that goal. Another element of the training in the program is what I'd call paraprofessional training. The idea being that it's not enough just to know the halachot, but it's also important to know about the fields that relate to the halacha. For example, I can learn a lot about Hilchot Nida, but as we, those of you who are here this morning, if we are actually dealing with a real couple and a real marital relationship, what I can offer is going to be substantially enhanced if I've had at least some training in what goes on in couples counseling, or what are typical challenges that a married couple faces, or what are they, what is done in the field of, let's say, sexual therapy, or what are some common gynecological phenomena during early marriage, or early pregnancy, or during infertility, you name it. The idea being to take seriously the integration of halachic knowledge and knowledge that comes from sort of the outside world. And by putting them together, to be able to offer a different level of quote-unquote consultation, right? The idea being that there are lots of halachic professionals out there, some more knowledgeable, some less knowledgeable, in related fields, that the yoetz et halacha should be able to understand, at the very least, to whom a couple should be referred for a specific type of consideration. But beyond that, to integrate tools from different related areas into the work and into what we do. The final step is certification. Certification as a yoetz et halacha comes when someone's taken both an oral test and has done an internship. The internship was just recently instituted. The oral test is a panel of four different rabbis, none of whom are the rabbis who trained in the program, who trained the students in the program. It's a little intimidating. It's also very, very interesting because each of the rabbis who gives the test has a sort of different perspective and a different element of what he's looking for, what is of concern for him, what does he want to see. And each woman has to pass the test and then undergo the internship. What the internship is a very structured series of sitting with women as they answer other women's questions to be able to see how it's done, writing and responding to questions that have been answered to before and having those written responses reviewed, doing different types of volunteering, teaching within a community to slowly build up someone's confidence. We didn't always have an internship program, in part because when the program first started, it was just so clear that what women were doing in the program was immediately necessary, that there wasn't even time to start thinking about it. It was very, very minimal. Now that we have something like 100 yoetzot in Israel, and increasingly yoetzot being trained in America, we're in a position where we can take more time to gradually move women into the field so that they come in with more and more tools. Because as we all know, there's a difference between learning something and doing it. And the internship is meant to really bridge that gap. The final thing I want to say about how women train or what the program is for yoetzot halacha, to become a yoetzot halacha, is that the different things that I've mentioned, I think, are also very relevant to a lot of discussions right now about future directions of women's learning and of women's Torah leadership. And that I think a lot of those discussions tend to center around rabbinical roles and whether or not women can take on rabbinical roles, how that might look. What's significant in part about the Yoetza program and how it's designed is that it's not fundamentally as it were, aping some kind of rabbinical school model. It's its own thing. It integrates many elements of what a rabbi would learn, but in taking so seriously other elements, like, for example, the paraprofessional training and having this highly specialized area of study, it's really creating a different type of model for how someone might train to be of use in a certain area of halacha in the community. And that, in and of itself, is groundbreaking. Okay, I'll stop for a moment. Just any more any questions about the training process, how a woman becomes yoetz et halacha? About what I've said? Nothing? It's pretty thorough. Okay. This is a good moment also just to introduce. We have sitting here Orashur Ziering. Orashur Ziering is a yoetz et halacha who trained in Israel and is now in Toronto, working at Opana and also running a Beit Midrash. 300 women, and as Yoetzet Halacha here in the greater Ontario area, we're hoping that some of what I share with you now are things that you'll be able to see more and more with Ora in practice. And of course, I invite Ora to jump in at any time if she has something to add, but I invite all of you to try to meet Ora later on, because you'll hear what I have to say, but it's also an opportunity to hear what she has to say. Okay. What do we do? Which is, I think, even more interesting than how we're trained to do it. Stand up. There she is. The one with the baby. Thank God. Okay. What do we do in the community? So there are a lot of different ways in which Yoetzet Halacha work within a community. One major element is teaching, running classes. And there's a range of different classes you can teach. You can teach kalot. As we said before, when you're a kal, it's not necessarily the best time to try to retain any type of information. So something that's also very popular is to teach refresher courses. Anywhere from 3 to 7 sessions, going over the laws of Nida for women who have been keeping them for a long time. Among other things, this creates an opportunity for women to ask questions that they were too embarrassed to ask along the way, which unfortunately is very, very common. It's also nice because it gives women an opportunity to see each other around these issues. So for example, let's say in my community of Ifrat, we've offered refresher courses. I'm not the only Yoetzet Halacha there. There are other Yoetzet Halacha. We work together. We've offered refresher courses in the community, but we've also offered from time to time specialized seminars on different topics. For example, we'll announce in the community we're going to run a seminar on menopause, and a cohort of 20-30 women from the community get together. And the advantage there is both that it's a refresher for specific topics in Talat Mishpacha, and that it's targeted. But beyond that, the women who come to learn are also having a chance within a communal setting to relate to each other's observing the halacha. One of the challenges of observing Talat Mishpacha is that it's often so private. I wouldn't say exactly lonely, but it's very individual. And the opportunity to see and hear other women around these topics can be very beneficial for everybody. A second type of thing we do in the community is meeting one-on-one with women. Woman calls up, she wants to come over, she wants to talk about an issue. This can be a whole range of things. She never thought she'd say this, but she's thinking about using contraception, or she never thought she'd say this, but she's thinking about going off of contraception, or she has a new health issue and she doesn't know what to do, or there's something going on in her marriage and it's affecting how they're observing Talat Mishpacha, or there's this one area of Talat Mishpacha that's been very confusing to her for a very long time, and she finally wants to have an opportunity to talk to someone about it. There's a whole range of reasons why someone might come over for one-on-one meeting. What's always interesting to me about these meetings is that there's a limited amount I know about where the meeting's going to go based on what the woman says at first. Meaning the stated reason for the meeting can be almost anything. But what actually happens in the meeting can be very different. A woman might be more comfortable saying she's coming because she wants to ask a question about onot and visatot, but what she really wants to talk about is contraception. Or she might be more comfortable saying she wants to talk about contraception, but what she really wants to talk about has to do with sexuality and what's permissible, or certain other elements of what's going on within her marriage. What's so special about the one-on-one connection, woman to woman, on these issues, I think it allows for a different type of freedom of discussion. Just the follow-up questions I'm allowed to ask, which might surprise us both. And I can't tell you how many times I've had a woman say, well, you know, now that you mention it, I've been wondering about this for a very, very long time. And we spend 10, 20, 30 minutes talking about something that she hadn't necessarily even planned to talk about. But because we were having a discussion, woman to woman, at her own pace, there was room for that. Rover Hoftig, one of the teachers and founders of the program, has said that the typical length of time for him to answer a Nida question is pretty brief, a few minutes at most. the typical amount of time for Yod Sota Lecha who work on the hotline is at least 15 minutes a question. Not always, there are quicker questions, but that's, let's say, the average. And that says something. It's not just that women don't get off the phone, but it's that when women don't get off the phone, it can be because there are things that women have to say or need a little time to have a chance to say or a little bit of comfort to be able to say. And that's something we like to facilitate. The third type of thing that happens is just the question, not really the meeting, not so much an appointment, as question. We're eating Shabbos lunch and there's a knock at my door and there's a couple with a batika cloth that they want me to look at. Or it's typically when there's no time is when this happens, you know. It's late afternoon and you get a phone call and the woman said, miscarriage, forgot to make a batika. Any number of things can be going on. A woman has a specific question and she wants an answer to that question. Sometimes those questions open up into discussions. Sometimes they become things with follow-ups. A woman calls about a miscarriage, I answer a question, tell her I'm very happy to take future questions. She calls back the next day and the next day. Don't hear from her for a week. Hear from her 2 weeks later. Don't hear from her for 6 months. See her and then she tells me that she's pregnant. There's a certain beauty to the opportunity for women to have access to this halachic address within their communities in different types of ways that enables it to become kind of a natural, ongoing dialogue throughout life. And that's particularly significant because many college teachers are careful to let women know, to let their kollel know that they can remain in contact after the wedding. It doesn't happen as often as we would like for it to happen. One of the things that's special about the Yod Zed Halacha relationship is that Nida and the dynamics of Nida change and shift over time in someone's life. And the relationship with the Yod Zed Halacha, in particular if it's someone in your community, is something that can also change and shift with you over time. You can move through these different issues together. So the woman who has a miscarriage can be the woman that I help prepare for childbirth, for labor, and she can also be the woman that I help find contraception later at a different stage, and it becomes very natural because I know her backstory and I understand what her particular concerns are. And of course, when there needs to be consultation with the rabbi, we'll get to that in a minute, I consult, or we consult, but it becomes a deep relationship. Of course, that can happen between a woman and a rabbi as well. I don't mean to suggest that it can't. I do think, however, that there's a special dynamic that often can take place between a woman and another woman. Also, not always the case. It's also possible for a woman not to relate as well to another woman. So each case, each situation to itself, and at the same time, I think that this giving more opportunities for these relationships to happen is what's important. So it's about time, making time for women. It's about laying their big connections with women. It's about follow-up. Other ways that we're accessible to women. One is our hotline. We run a phone hotline. The genesis of the phone hotline is that when we graduated our first cohort of Yod Sod, women started calling them. They started calling them any time of day, all the time. And it quickly got out of hand. And it became understood that this was not going to work. There had to be some kind of clear framework for how women could both reach out and how it wouldn't wind up completely taking over. So it is still the case, for example, I'll still get calls at random from women in my community who might prefer someone in their community or who might not want to wait for hotline hours. There could be a lot of reasons for that. At the same time, all women know, we try to make it possible for as many women as possible to know that we have this hotline. It has a certain amount of hours that it's open. It's available, it's free, it's toll-free, I think, also from Canada. We're, Bezrat Hashem, this year we're going to add more hours that are suitable for North America, now that we have more of a cohort of North American Yod Sod. That's something that we're looking to do. Hotline is largely based in Israel, but we're looking to add hours based on the fact that we have more Yod Sod here. And the hotline becomes another resource. It also can be anonymous, if a woman wants it to be anonymous, but it can also be that she leaves a message, receives a response. It's also an opportunity for different women, different Yod Sod, to get involved in Yod Sod Halacha work, and for that work to be very clearly supervised. everything is carefully logged and there's rabbinic supervision. Another way that we reach out to the community is through our website. Website is actually a passion of mine. I started out working on the hotline and I discovered that it was not the perfect fit for my personality. What do I mean? I couldn't go to sleep after I got off the phone. The shift ended at midnight and I would just be replaying the conversations in my mind till 2 or 3 a.m. thinking about what I wished I had said or hoping that a woman had understood me properly. It's a function of personality as much as anything else. I shifted to the website. The website is full of a lot of different types of information. One is a question and answer service. Now you might ask, why would a woman want to write her question as opposed to calling up with a question? The answer is because sometimes it's more comfortable to write a question than to call up with a question. Sometimes you don't want someone to hear your voice. Sometimes something's painful for you. Sometimes you just have your cell phone in hand. You know it'll take 5 minutes. You don't want to worry about calling and talking. You want to put your question in, and it's okay for you to wait a little bit till you get your answer out. We do find that there's a lot of overlap between the areas of questions that we get on the hotline and the areas of questions that we get on the website. But even so, oftentimes the questions on the website, I'd say we get a higher percentage. A study was done of this. We get a higher percentage of questions about sexual issues and a higher percentage of questions about contraception on the website than on the hotline, which makes some sense because those are questions that women might feel a little more vulnerable asking about, and there are also questions that in theory a woman could wait a little longer to receive a response for. And what we're trying to do also with the website is educate. So whereas on the hotline there's always a tension between answering the question and trying to bring up another area of halacha that might be important for a woman to learn, on the website, because it's the internet, we have all kinds of articles that are posted. You see here, if you can see on the slide, we have the drop-down menus and then sub-articles and then even posted questions within the website. What it means is that if a woman asks a question and we answer it, we can also hyperlink to 3 related articles as they come up in the answer, which gives her easy access to halachic education in addition to the direct answer to her question, which is very important because we don't just want to answer a woman's question. We want to put her in a position where she understands more about what she's asking and why she might ask something like it or not ask something like it in the future. Something else that we do on the website is we've started to have a blog on the website, and that's been an opportunity to start to address issues that come up in the public sphere that might be relevant. For example, earlier this year, someone came up with an app for stains. I think it was called the Stain Checker app. And a colleague of mine, Hindi Ginsburg, wrote a response within, I think, 2 days to the Stain Checker app, what the strengths were of the idea and what the weaknesses were to the idea, why even though there is an app, it's still probably in a woman's best interest not to follow it, aside from the fact that, unfortunately, there were some substantial errors within the app. And she wrote that, and that went on her blog. So what we've also done is we've created a forum through the website to also communicate ideas or thoughts about issues related to Taharat Mishpacha that are coming up in the public sphere at different times. Another thing we're working on with web media is movies. We have a series that we've started putting up on YouTube because not everyone wants to read an article. We can refer a woman to an article on stains, but there are women who might retain the information better or appreciate the information better if they will watch a movie about it. So we've started to produce movies and put them up on the site. And we also have, you might see Racheli Frankel, who is very well known, is there on the left. Dina Zimmerman, a senior colleague of mine, is over there. Dr. Dina Zimmerman, she actually spoke here, I think, at a medical ethics conference a few years ago. And in addition to the movies, we're starting to explore to see if we could also allow for appointments via Skype with Yotzot Halacha through the website, which would be another level of utilizing new media to reach out to women about Taharat Mishpacha. Another thing we're doing is we're expanding our class offerings and language offerings online. So you see we now have Spanish and French question answering opportunities online because women it's not just women in Israel, America that have questions, but it's also women in other countries who speak other languages. And we're hoping to continue to build up our presence in other languages. And then beyond that, We also offer classes now, Kala class online, a refresher class online. Those are still largely text-based, but they're good starts. In particular, they're helpful for women either who are learning or have learned but are not sure how well they've retained the information they've learned with the Kala teacher or want to double-check what they've learned with the Kala teacher. They're also useful for women who don't have access to Kala teachers, which happens all the time. Not everyone has access to good teaching prior to their wedding. It's an opportunity for people to learn, and those courses have built into them functionality to be able to ask questions. Okay, so those are some of the different activities we do officially as Yod Sod. Before I get into the next topic, just do you have questions? Yeah. It's an excellent question. So the community work is generally speaking unpaid. There are a few Yod Sod who have made deals within their communities to get a salary, but in America, in North America, there is a model that's growing of women affiliated with communities being paid by, let's say, a consortium of shuls or by one major shul in the community to service the community as a paid yoetzet halacha. That's ideal in a certain way because we're dealing with, for the most part, yoetzet halacha are Jewish women with families and careers beyond being yoetzet halacha. So if we can provide financial support, the remuneration enables these women to give more to the community, create more programming, devote more time to questions. It's to everybody's benefit when it can be done. And that's actually Atara Ice, who Rabbi Jay was in touch with, is largely responsible for helping women find roles within North American communities. In Israel, it's much more difficult in terms of payment. In Israel, they don't pay rabbis for shuls for the most part, or if they do, it's token payment. So to start talking about paying the yoetzet is almost like pie in the sky. It's not something that's never happened. It's unusual. What we do sometimes when women offer classes in the community, sometimes those are for a fee, and some of that money might go to the yoetzet halacha, just like a college teacher might sometimes take a fee and get some money. Nishmats, the women who work on the website and on the hotline do get paid for working in those frameworks because there's a very serious professional responsibility that if it were volunteer, it wouldn't happen, meaning it can't be that the hotline, that someone's going to miss it one night and not take it seriously because she's not going to get paid. So that has to be paid. And so through the website, it can't be the questions just don't get looked at. So those positions are paid, though on a very low scale, because we're talking about really a very serious nonprofit effort here. So really a lot of this work is getting done. I'm sorry?
We have to change
it. It would be...
The
only way it can change really is through the community. Through community either supporting our work or through community understanding the importance of this. What we've seen is that when women do get there really is a difference between a yoetzet halacha. For example, I and my colleagues in Efrat, we do different programs on a volunteer basis in Efrat, and we're very happy to offer what we can offer volunteering in Efrat. If we were to have a paid position within the community as yoetzet halacha, it wouldn't be once every 4 months that we run a program or once every 6 months. It would be much more frequent. Or we'd be able to say there's an official office hours as opposed to, you know, call when you need it. People are it's not always comfortable for women to call when they can't pay. Sometimes it's more comfortable to feel that they're paying. So this
interesting, if I could, I was just at the other session for a few minutes, probably this you know, pay for organs. And Rabbi Kuka said, not only can you pay, you can't pay a little bit. Some of the courses can say, because then it does, you have to pay that it's real money, right. Otherwise that doesn't matter. It's just sort of interesting, the overlap on the two, since I'm probably the only one.
it really is interesting. It's also interesting because one of the things also that's going on with more women taking on more clergy-type positions is sometimes there are synagogues that are saying, well, we can pay one woman, we'll want to pay a woman to take an assistant rabbi type of a role, but not a yoetzet halacha. We're really talking about different things, though. It's not impossible for a woman who's taking an assistant rabbi type of a role to fulfill many of the functions of yoetzet halacha. It's also not impossible for a woman who's taking on an official yoetzet halacha role to fulfill many of the roles of an assistant rabbi. That's really the difference between having a specialist in this area in halacha available to the community as opposed to kind of like a general practitioner. And let's say in a high percentage, let's say 60% of the time, that might not make a difference, but you don't want to be in one of those percentages of the time where it does make a difference. I know that because I deal with women who have asked questions to general practitioners, and sometimes being a specialist can really make a difference for those women. One of the other interesting features to our work as Yotzot Halacha is that we don't work in a vacuum. It's not just about communities and what kind of community support we have. It's also about partnerships with the other structures that already exist within a community. For example, rabbis. Yotzot Halacha in a community has to find a way to work with the rabbis in her community. It's inevitable that it will have to happen. For example, there's a halachic question, and it's subject to debate, and the rabbi of the community has a strong opinion about it. That's something she really needs to know. Or someone asks a question, they call up and they say, well, usually I ask her of such and such, but I thought I'd try you. There's a certain responsibility to understand what's usually done. Or, and this happens as well, I asked her of such and such, and I didn't understand this and that. Can we talk about it? Those kinds of conversations can't take place in a healthy and productive way if there isn't some degree of mutual respect and collaboration. As you might imagine, this sometimes works out in a smoother way than others. It depends a lot on the personalities that are involved, on the community. On the whole, our goal is to try to approach these issues with humility and with respect to the rabbis that are on the scene, and not to have anyone engaged in a game of, we're not trying to replace anybody. We're trying to work with people. For example, when I started working in Efrat, Feli Yoetzet and I met with a group of rabbis in the community to ask, how can we fit into what you're doing? Or if they're going to advertise us, we'd like it to be along with a list of the rabbis who answered questions in Talat Mishpacha. Again, it's not always the easiest thing to work out, but that's obviously going to be the best step for any woman in the community, also men in the community, to know. I've had cases where I've worked with a woman intensively on a Tarat Mishpacha question, and including consulting with rabbis along the way. And at the last stage, I've received a call from my husband saying, I need to know what rabbi said this is okay. And if I hadn't been in consultation or collaboration along the way, we would have had a real problem from his perspective, because he has the right to feel comfortable with whatever halachic ruling his wife is working with. It's not just rabbis that we have to work with. Doctors, very important for us to understand how to work with physicians, or how to help women work with their physicians, because so many of the questions in Torah Mishpacha also overlap areas of women's health. And if we don't understand what the doctor is saying, or if the doctor can't understand what the woman's concerns are, then it's going to be very hard for the halakha to be correct. Halakha, as I'm sure will come up if it hasn't come up already in this conference, the Jewish medical halakha, one major component is that the medical facts have to be accurate, and they're taken very seriously, very much into account. So the more that there's dialogue and communication, the better. One thing that we've developed as Yotzot Halacha is a sister website for healthcare professionals, so that, for example, if a woman wants to tell her physician that she's concerned about X, we have a website where we've written out how to explain X about Hilchot Nida in a way that a physician can understand, where it's prioritized and written for that physician, so he can see, he or she can see what the concerns are in a clear way. And we recently made that into a free app, so that women can take with them on their cell phones, they're meeting with their physician, and they think, oh, there might be a ramification here for Talat Mishpacha, and she has the app, and she has access to show her physician on the spot, here are other considerations that are real for me. And that's part of a physician's job, too, is to understand the background of his client and what they're going to do. It's going to affect compliance, it's going to affect what's the appropriate medical step for the patient. So, that's another element of what we do. We also have to work with Madrichot Kala in the community. Sometimes we'll get feedback about, well, this Kala was taught in this way. I've had this from a local rabbi. This Kala was taught in this way, this Madrichot Kala. Can you set her straight? I don't have anyone getting to it, but I was supposed to. It was not a simple situation at all. Not going to go into how we dealt with it, but it is important for there to be communication between the Madrichot Kala and other people working in the area in the community. There's also something called Bodkot Tara. Those are women nurses who are trained to see if a woman has some kind of a wound, trauma, lesion that might be causing her to have bleeding. There also needs to be communication there. And there are other types of professionals. Psychologists can sometimes be very important. Certain leniencies depend on there being a shat hadchak, a pressing halachic situation. Sometimes that can be psychological. But to evaluate whether or not psychologically pressing situations sometimes requires involving a professional, mikveh attendants in the community. There are any number of people in the community, if you think about it, who are involved with Taharat Mishpacha. And one of the things that we try to do as Yotzot Halacha is to work collaboratively as much as possible with as many of them as possible. One thing that I have found in dealing with people and trying to work collaboratively in different cases, which is very interesting, is that with the other person involved, whether it's the rabbi, the physician, what have you, I often feel like my role is to kind of represent the woman to them, the woman as she's trying to keep her halachic observance. With the woman, I often feel that my role is more trying to present the halacha to her. It's an interesting type of dynamic to see the same case from a lot of different points of view. If you think about it, though, everything I've been saying is already sort of in the DNA of the program and how it's built. Because when you have a program that's built on a combination of scholarship, but also an ethos of trying to contribute to the community and a sense of integrating classical halachic learning with practical halachic knowledge and with related fields, what it does is it prepares someone to look at women and their halachic questions with an eye to creating an integrative approach with all the different types of professionals or considerations that might be involved. So that's really what we're trying to do. Am I out of time? Do you have another couple minutes? Or?
You have until 1:30.
So oh, okay, great.
You can really control how much you want to do.
Oh, I see what you're saying. No, but I don't, okay. Just another couple things. I'll take questions and we'll start the next presentation, I guess. When the program started, so again, this is 1997 the program started, and one of the big questions, I think, was not just what the Yotzot Halacha would be then, but what would Yotzot Halacha be later on? For example, I mentioned that I work on the website. Anytime I answer a question, Rav Henkin looks over the question before it's sent out to the questioner. If it has a medical component, Dr. Dina Zimmerman, who's Yotzot Halacha and a physician, looks at the question before it's sent out to the questioner. So too, we have a therapist that will look at stuff if it's important to see. There are different types of consultations involved before things get set out. And I think when we were starting or when the program was in an earlier stage, there was a lot of talk about this question again of yotzot or poskot or how much responsibility are you taking or when will you be able to stand on your own two feet and that sort of a thing. What I think has happened over time, as more and more of us have gotten more and more involved in the areas and in the halacha, is that those questions have become less and less important. By which I mean that we savor and we look for genuine dialogue with rabbis in our communities who are willing to help us, to consult with us, or to guide us on questions. That only helps us do a better job to help the women that we're working with. It's become much less about how important our independence might be or our status might be, which I don't think was driving us in the first place, but was still something that a lot of people raised. And it's really just more about, more and more all the time, it's about how can we do a better job? How can we reach more women? How can we help more people? And I think that's the right direction for these types of things to take. Okay, if there are any questions, please shoot. Otherwise, I think we'll take 5 and then we'll start session 2.
Session 2 is practical questions on a day-to-day basis, the actual.
Yeah.